The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Jemima Kish, and this week's programme is an established tradition for this time of year. It's the Tech Weekly annual review. Not only that, but this is our third anniversary programme, so happy birthday to us. Over the next half an hour or so, we'll be raking over the coals of the highlights and lowlights in the technology world in 2010. Next week, we'll be getting out the crystal ball to forecast what's in store for 2011. But stop, let's not get too carried away with ourselves. We've got a whole 12 months of technology to look back at. Joining me, looking back at gaming, Google, government, mobiles, Microsoft and digital media, is our panel. In the studio, we have The Guardian's games correspondent, Keith Stewart, and Paid Content UK's editor, Robert Andrews. Welcome both.
Hello. Hello, Merry Christmas.
What's on your Christmas list?
I don't have any games on there because I've actually got all the games I want this year.
That's not a bad situation to be
in. Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah, I'm quite lucky, actually. I just need to... On my Christmas list is the space to actually play Kinect.
Dear Father Christmas, I'd like some space.
Yeah, I just need 8 foot in front of my television. Thanks, Santa.
Robert?
A nice rest, please.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah, I'm much the same. Anyway, send us your more ambitious Christmas requests. Let's step in the DeLorean now and set the dials for last January as we kick off the Tech Weekly review of 2010. The first big technology announcement of 2010 was the announcement of a Google-branded phone, the Nexus One, which kicked off a good year for the Android platform. In the US, Android market share overtook the iPhone in May, and the Android operating system has seen numerous improvements and updates this year. Despite playing down rumours of a second Nexus model, Google ended the year by announcing the Nexus S, another own-brand phone with NFC technology. So, Robert, a good year for Android. Were they good phones? Will Google be pleased with Android's performance?
It was a good year for Android. I said about 12 months ago that this would be the year of Android. And I think at this point, more Android phones are shipping than iPhones. I think you can declare Google Android a success on that basis. And, of course, that's because it's not just been one hardware manufacturer making Android phones. It's been all kinds of manufacturers. That has meant that the quality of some of those phones has been patchy. But this was the year in which a lot of people became first adopters of smartphones. For example, my girlfriend, I took her shopping recently and converted her from an old Nokia candy bar style phone to a nice LG Android phone. And you can see a very big adoption curve there. So patchy in terms of handset quality, but culminating, I think, at the end of the year in some really good handsets. I switched from an iPhone to this Samsung Galaxy S. I'm very happy with it. It's essentially the Google Nexus S. And I think it portends for great things next year.
What was really the issue with the Nexus One? Because I had one of these, and Google has discontinued this phone, and there was a sense it was perhaps a little too ambitious.
It wasn't so much a technology problem. I know people who jumped on board the Nexus One bandwagon and are still faithful users of the handset. The problem was the retail and distribution strategy. Google decided to boldly try and break up the traditional way that mobile phones are sold, which is through the carriers, and instead to sell it itself on google.com/phone. But not many people went down that road.
2010 wasn't all rosy for Google. In January, they announced they were to stop censoring search results in China after what was considered to be a cyber attack to gain information on human rights activists. The search company ended up pulling out of mainland China and relocating to Hong Kong. Here's Google chief executive Eric Schmidt talking to The Guardian's editor Alan Rusbridger in July.
The way the censorship works is the Chinese government has what is known as the Great Firewall of China, which sits there. And you're not allowed to talk about it very much, but basically content goes through it and then some content doesn't make it to the other side, and that's how the censorship is done. As part of our operations in mainland China, we needed a license called an ICP license in order to run our businesses there. And the Chinese government said, look, you have to make a few more changes, you have to get rid of what is called the redirect, and we didn't exactly have a lot of choice. I want to be clear that the Chinese government has the arbitrary ability to shut Google down in China, mainland China, if they should choose to. So far, they have not done so, and we would hope that they would not.
In May, it came to light Google had collected data from unsecured Wi-Fi networks while gathering data for its Street View service. In July, the Information Commissioner cleared Google of any wrongdoing, saying it was unlikely any significant amount of personal data had been collected. Unfortunate, then, that in October, Google revealed there was more sensitive information in the data than first thought, when the Canadian Information Commissioner found passwords and emails in the data, forcing his UK counterpart to reopen the case. What a mess. Robert, this was a bit of a balls up on the part of the UK Information Commissioner, wasn't it? I mean, they should have picked up the fact that there were whole emails and whole passwords in this data.
Yeah, and astonishing that a company like Google would have been actually collecting that information in the first place. At the end of the day, it's probably not going to have a particularly great security effect on users. To me, this was almost the year of the fail in many ways for some of the big companies. We're all familiar with the fail Twitter hashtag at this point. But, you know, Google has made several product missteps this year, notably Wave and Buzz haven't been particularly successful, misstepping on privacy. And there's sort of a real crisis around some of these big firms. You know, iPhone with AntennaGate. I wonder what collectively happened to go so wrong with some of the big companies this year.
Just that they're now so big that perhaps a little bit of failure is inevitable. Doesn't it show that they're also pushing things a bit more? They're pushing our acceptance and tolerance and understanding of privacy, for example, and they're pushing their own development, perhaps, in a way that's a little more risky.
The Apple antenna situation was just remarkable to me because that wasn't even anything to do with the complications around privacy. It was just a piece of engineering that you couldn't imagine Apple making a mistake on. It's the fundamentals of their business, great industrial design, and to have something, you know, where you couldn't get a signal because your hand was holding it wrong. And there, even worse was how they dealt with it initially, trying to say that you're holding your phone wrong. And Apple can tell us to do a lot of things, but to tell us how to hold our phones just seems, you know, bizarre.
Well, we will go into this in a little more detail later on. Back on Google, how do you think Google is playing it in China?
In truth, Google has been one of the most effective weapons in US-China relations that the White House could have had. It's always been very sensitive for the White House itself to go criticising China in public. But for Google to have done this under the guise of technology and economic openness has actually turned out to be very useful in the whole context of US-China relations, I think.
And Buzz and Wave as well. This was another big screw-up that you touched on earlier for Google. What exactly went wrong there? What was the problem with Buzz and Wave, and why did they end up having to do U-turns on both of those?
Google Wave was an admirable attempt at reinventing email, which is due for some pretty significant changes, I think, but has turned out to be not a product that actually people want to use. Buzz, again, you know, it seemed an admirable attempt at aggregating and pulling together all of these social identities and the proliferating number of online identities we have. But it turns out people are not so interested. But I'm going to be interested to see what Google does next year with its social strategy. People continue to rumour that they're coming out with a Facebook killer. I don't believe that's going to happen. I don't believe it's in Google's interest. But I do believe it's in Google's interests to inject some kind of social into their products.
I was going to say, I think the problem with what Google's tried is that a lot of the times that these big changes in social media don't tend to happen from the top down, as far as I know. If you just take the example of Facebook, I can't imagine if that started with an enormous corporation like Google. These things tend to sort of be crowdsourced and proliferate organically. So I just think people are almost naturally adverse to having enormous corporations come along and saying, you're doing email wrong, you've got to do it like this. And it just doesn't, I just don't think it works like that.
Well, bearing that in mind, what kind of year have they had for Chrome OS? I mean, 2 weeks ago we saw the Chrome Web Store launched with some really interesting browser extensions and things. But how well received has Chrome been this year?
The Chrome browser is a fantastic browser. It's really quick, it's really light and agile. Its share is growing very healthily. The prospect of turning that into the OS itself seems really appealing for those of us who increasingly use web apps. I wonder whether that's how far that's going to succeed, because as great as that sounds for a lot of people, there are still going to be many people who will wonder, it doesn't come with iTunes? How am I going to play my music, for example? Chrome Web Store, like Wave, like Buzz, seem to me a reaction to a previous technology invention and successful technology product. In the case of it is what Google calls essentially an app store, but these things aren't apps. They're web apps, but they're web hosted applications that existed usually already. And that makes Google Web Store essentially a collection of links to those hosted apps. And it seems to me to be a reaction to iTunes App Store and an attempt to regain ground that they seemingly have lost on that front.
Well, we touched on some of the politics earlier of the situation between Google and China, but there have been some significant political developments within the tech world here in the UK.
We took a decision to support this bill in principle. We've said that we would love to have scrutinised the clauses that are being debated now. We would have loved to have tabled amendments and have them debated in this House, but we supported the principle that something should be done to combat illegal file sharing.
The question is, the amendment be made? Does Mepin say aye?
Aye.
The contrary, no.
No!
Division! Aye. Clear, lobbies!
That was the Digital Economy Bill being rushed through the House of Commons in April in the dying days of the Labour government, resulting in 42 important clauses being considered in just 5 minutes, despite them relating to matters like file sharing, broadband rollout, and tax breaks for video game development. Those tax breaks were a casualty of the new coalition government in May, when Chancellor George Osborne announced his emergency budget in June. More recently, new communications minister Ed Vasey raised eyebrows when he suggested ISPs should ditch the principle of net neutrality, and, at the weekend, that ISPs should block pornography. There were also interesting noises about creating Tech City, a hub for technology innovation, in London's East End, and the release of the Coins database on Treasury spending, as well as lots of other government data. Lovely stuff. Keith, the Digital Economy Act. This was a bit of a farce, wasn't it? Did it really get the scrutiny that it deserved?
I think in your introduction, I think you pretty much answered that question. Was it 42 important clauses in just 5 minutes?
Yeah.
They must have all been on Red Bull to get through that. And it speak volumes about a government and a parliament that try to talk about technology, and in the end, they just kind of brush it into a pigeonhole and then just eject it from the whole parliamentary process. It was absolutely ridiculous. And it's weird because for a lot of people from my generation were looking at that, and it was the first, for a lot of people, a lot of gamers and a lot of technologists were really interested in that. And for a lot of them, that was their first understanding and look at how the parliamentary process works. And it was just, it made a farce out of the whole thing. It was utterly ridiculous, but almost funny if it wasn't so tragic.
Yes, yeah, so they had an opportunity to engage people in and educate them in a very practical way about the process and what was going on and how they could have a part in that. And they chose to do so with a very important bill that they totally alienated a whole group of very important people. But Robert, where are we at with the Digital Economy Act?
Well, Jeremy Hunt, the Culture Minister, has said that
Jeremy Hunt?
Jeremy. you can't catch me out that easy.
Okay.
Has said that he won't repeal the Act, which, you know, I think you have to take in its entirety. He won't repeal any part of it. Ofcom recently has been consulting on how to implement some of the anti-piracy measures, but a lot of this remains to be implemented in actual fact. And so the British phonographic industry last week released some statistics that showed, despite the Digital Economy Act coming into law, 2010 actually saw something like 1.2 billion illegally downloaded songs, which they equate to something like £984,000 in lost revenue. It's received royal assent, but it hasn't yet worked because it hasn't yet been implemented. Next year, I think, as we're going to talk about next week, there are going to be several attempts at a second bite at the cherry with this stuff. I think we're going to find that the whole Pandora's box could be reopened again.
Mm. Keith, the games tax breaks, these had a lot of people really interested and excited, and it finally sounded like the government was putting their money where their mouth was.
Yeah.
Big blow to the industry?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's difficult because there are two views on this. And obviously the TIGA, the Industries Game Development Association, were massively vocal in their support and their pushing through of tax breaks. And Richard Wilson, the head of TIGA, was very confident before the election that the tax breaks would obviously go through. Labour had said, yes, this is going to happen. And also the Liberals and the Conservative parties were both on record saying, yes, we support tax breaks for the games industry. And then obviously they came into power. There was that little note left for them in the Treasury saying there's no more money. And suddenly everything's changed and tax breaks went out of the window. I mean, there is a vocal minority that says... that tax breaks wouldn't necessarily be a benefit for the British industry. The British industry has got to make its own way in this industry. There are other funding opportunities available, but none of them quite as helpful as tax breaks would have been. I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the UK is losing out to countries which are offering tax breaks. For example, Canada. TIGA did a survey last year and found that 23% of UK game developers had lost staff to foreign countries, with lots of those going to Canada. It's a difficult climate for business anyway, but if you cannot compete against companies in, say, Canada, where they're getting massive amounts of their salaries paid for by the government, then that's difficult to compete with.
Yeah, and although the government has said that it won't repeal the Act, that doesn't necessarily mean that it won't supersede some of the clauses with different or, in some cases, better provisions. For example, the broadband policy, whereas the Act, as written under Labour, was to introduce perhaps a derisory 2 megabits per second broadband nationwide. The Condem government has come in and said, well, actually, we're going to make it super fast and still nationwide, and this is how we're going to do it, funding from the BBC. So although it's not, the law isn't going to be revoked, there may yet be substantial opportunity for change.
Where are we at with net neutrality? Was Ed Vasey just sort of flying a kite to see what reaction he got? And what do we think of the BBC's sort of traffic light response to... Is that a good idea?
So I think we're approaching sort of a reality moment with net neutrality, as unappealing as it might sound for ideological reasons. If you look at it through the telco and ISP's lens, they're rapidly approaching kind of a crash point, particularly the mobile carriers, who this year stepped back from unlimited mobile internet data and are now capping data. You can easily imagine a similar scenario coming on the fixed line networks. In fact, this year Sky reverted to offering free broadband only up to a certain limit, and thereafter you have to pay. So it's coming.
Tech City. encouraging largely London-based startups to relocate from, say, Shoreditch to Stratford. Is that really going to happen?
Well, all that way.
Yeah, all that way. Well, anyway, I mean, if you're going to uproot, you need fairly good incentives to do it. Was what was on the table in Stratford appealing enough, do you think? Or is it just, you know, is this more Tory PR?
I'm enamoured with the idea that, you know, hey, location no longer matters, and people can form startups online. You do have, you know, several small startups being formed with some of the guys working in the Ukraine, some other of their colleagues located in, you know, parts of England and so on. It seems to work. But over the last year or two, this idea of Silicon Roundabout seems to have gained some momentum and is now gaining notoriety across Europe. And
so it's something. There's something for the Condems to latch onto and stick something fashionable in their, well, not just their manifesto, but, you know, they want to be seen to be doing things in this area. But is there any real substance to this, or is it just, you know, nicely spun?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think if there's substance, then it's coming, as Keith said earlier, from the ground up, not from the top down. And I think, you know, you have to credit the developers who are in Silicon Roundabout with having created that sort of gravitational pull.
We used to, in the games industry, we used to these hubs setting up organically.
Like Dundee.
Yeah, exactly, like Dundee. There's Leamington as well, Leamington Spa, there's lots of developers there. Lots in Brighton as well. The similar sorts of companies you're getting in the Silicon Roundabout are the same sort of things that you're getting in Brighton, you know, these digital creative agencies. And that tends to be kind of an organic movement. And again, you know, trying to set these things up, I just think tends to be doomed to failure because people go where they want to go.
Okay, before we continue, let's just see how we did on our predictions of last year. Keith, we HD.
I didn't predict that. So
you can't back out now. In the program.
That definitely wasn't one of mine.
It was Bobby.
Ah, well, there you go.
Scapegoat.
That didn't happen. Yeah. What an idiot.
What was he thinking?
How was that going to happen? No, that didn't. In fact, there weren't any significant hardware advancements to Wii this year, which some people see as a kind of mistake for Nintendo, because obviously Move's come out and Kinect's come out, and there was no Wii equivalent apart from the Motion Plus that they'd already released. So I don't know, maybe E3 this year is going to see more of an announcement. I don't know, but Nintendo obviously have got the 3DS, the 3D handheld coming out in the spring, and that's probably going to form the basis of their kind of hardware announcements next year. But you never know, maybe they'll come up with something at E3.
I think we could probably do better on 3D. This was definitely a massive year for 3D, wasn't it?
In the cinema, it's been big. The big movie studios obviously have loved it because it makes piracy in the cinema, you know, almost redundant for certain big releases. People are paying more to go and see 3D films, so that's good. Everything's gone 3D. There haven't been enormous amounts of 3D disasters for them. In games and at home, still really, really early. There's only been a few 3D games so far. There hasn't been a massive 3D pusher in the games world.
I'm a bit sceptical about the whole 3D thing because I just see it as a way for film companies and content companies to make a little bit more money. Yeah, it's money for old rope, really, isn't it? It's just a film, but we'll charge you a little bit more because you can wear some silly glasses and there's a bit of an effect on the screen. And ditto TV sets, you know, they're not really selling, are they? Where 3D does fulfil its promise is actual 3D printing, 3D printing. Mm. That gets really exciting.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to make little plastic cups for £800 at home, then
be generous. It's a nascent technology.
Yeah, yeah. But so is 3D. I can completely understand that. Okay. I think if there's going to be somewhere it shines, it maybe will be in games. I played Killzone 3D at E3, and there is a definite sensory bonus to some degree with 3D, being able to pick out objects in the distance and being able to pick out foliage from actual moving polygonal characters is a little bit easier in 3D, but a little bit easier probably doesn't warrant spending a grand on a new television.
Third one, augmented reality. So this is something with incredible potential, but is still rather crude. And if you look at an app like Layer, the mobile app, that's really interesting, but a bit crude, isn't it? So yes, it's kind of been successful, but not really there yet. Is that a fair summary?
This is something that advertisers have really, really latched onto massively over the last 2 years. And, you know, we've seen people like Kellogg's using a lot of augmented reality stuff. So you can get breakfast cereals with augmented reality stuff on the cereal boxes. So you can put it up to a webcam and it displays characters on your cereal box. Advertisers have loved it. I haven't seen that many apps which have used it that interestingly.
Yeah, I think 12 months ago we said, it's going to be there. It's still going to be a little bit gimmicky. And I think that's where we are. There is not Layer, but one of the other augmented reality mobile apps is due to come out with an augmented reality in-car GPS navigation app. So you mount it on your dash and you're not looking at a bird's eye depiction of the road, but you're looking at the road through the camera with your route laid over that picture. And I think that's going to be popular. I think in a couple of short years, we'll probably wonder, why wasn't sat-nav always that way?
Our final prediction was that we would see the emergence of this device.
We'd like to show it to you today for the first time. And we call it the iPad. So, it's very thin. And what this device does is extraordinary.
So massive props for Apple on the release of the iPad and popularising the tablet form factor, resulting in a 70% jump in quarterly profits in October. They now have $50 billion in the bank. But it's been an up and down year for Apple too. The low point when Steve Jobs had to climb on stage at a press conference just 3 weeks after iPhone 4 went on sale to address the AntennaGate death grip, the cause of dropped calls on the device. This was just part of what had been a complicated birth for the phone, following the theft of a production device which was discovered by Gizmodo, the tech blog, who splashed the details on the new model 2 months before the release. Steve is probably only now regaining his composure. So, was this a good year for Apple or a bad year? Was it the year of fail, as you suggested earlier, Robert?
It was the year of antenna fail, but curiously, it didn't hurt Apple too much, you know, financially.
Evidently not, for they've got $50 billion in the bank.
They took a graze financially, I think, but this was the year that Apple became even cooler. Its gadgets were even more the must gadgets to have. And, you know, they'll bring another one out next year, and I think we'll do it all over again.
Did it show that they are not perfect? And what impact did that have on the consumer perception of Apple? Or was it just a sort of industry obsession that something had actually gone wrong for once?
It has become clear to me that their products are far from perfect. There are frustrations that it's possible to have with the closed way that they do things.
Keith, are you an iPad user?
I have got an iPad, but I don't really use it. So, an ambiguous answer.
What was your quick review of it? Any surprises? Any favourite apps?
My favourite app, obviously, is Eyewitness. But
obviously.
Yeah, and Cut the Rope.
Guardian's Eyewitness.
Sorry. Yeah. No, I was surprised by how little I used it. And I'm interested in the fact that most people use it as their second screen in the living room that I've spoken to. And, you know, it's something that people will surf the web on while they're watching television.
So the lost iPhone business, Robert, that arguably did Apple a little bit more damage, didn't it? I mean, it really stole their thunder, their secretive process and launch of devices. They love to have that absolutely nailed down. And that was unprecedented, wasn't it, having a device leaked?
Yeah, and I wondered, you know, how I would have felt if I was Apple and one of my secret products had got out. You know, Steve is renowned as being a robust guy who will go after these people.
He had a 97% approval rating in the Glassdoor Best Places in the World to Work among employees, 97%.
Well, the other 3% of people have left prototype technologies in bars.
Yeah, pretty much. That didn't go down well. Also, the row with Adobe over Flash. Steve Jobs famously sent an open letter saying why Adobe and Flash was so rubbish. But now Android is starting to include Flash. Do you think perceptions are going to change a bit on that front?
No, I actually think there's now a critical, and I mean critical, mass behind this sort of anti-Flash movement that is going to gather pace next year. You mentioned Android, but in actual fact, both Google and Apple and many other people are behind HTML5, which is the perceived alternative in web standards. Problem with HTML5 is it's still on the drawing board, really, and the guy doing the drawing is from Google. But that standard could come to fruition at the end of next year, and I think it would actually benefit a lot of users if we increasingly move toward HTML.
Okay, folks, we're about halfway through our review of 2010. Let's look at what the year was like for the games industry.
A lie is a lie. Just because they write it down and call it history doesn't make it the truth. We live in a world where seeing is not believing.
I rode in a gang. They left me to die after I'd been shot. I left the gang after the gang left me.
Commander.
Didn't think anyone survived Bagassi, sir.
Spartans never died, George. They're just missing in action.
Those were clips from three of the year's biggest games, Black Ops, Red Dead Redemption and Halo Reach, and we'll get onto those in a moment. But there was interesting hardware released this year, a movement, if you pardon the pun, towards gesture or motion-based control. Sony released the PlayStation Move controller in September, shortly followed by Microsoft's Kinect Xbox attachment in November, both probably in a lot of Christmas stockings this year. There were some interesting trends in gaming, social gaming and gamification, becoming interesting new ways of interacting and engaging with games. Keith, on those three big titles, take us through each one and just tell us why they were so successful.
With two of them, I don't think there's any kind of mystery to why they were successful. Call of Duty Black Ops is obviously part of one of the biggest gaming franchises, or if not the biggest gaming franchise in the world, and it did spectacularly well, much better than Modern Warfare 2. Well, significantly better. Most people didn't think it would touch Modern Warfare 2 because the Modern Warfare series is by Infinity Ward, which is the company that created Call of Duty, whereas Black Ops is by Treyarch, which is another developer that tends to work on the other titles when Infinity Ward are sort of busy on their own. It was, though, a really good piece of mainstream entertainment, video game entertainment, and was the benchmark, really, for mainstream gaming this year, I think, in a lot of ways.
Mark out of 5?
I gave it 5, because I'm aware that probably wouldn't be the mark that a lot of the other Guardian reviewers would have given it, but I just, as a piece of, unapologetic mainstream entertainment, it's just so beautifully made, and so much in there, and there's... I think Treyarch are one of those companies that just absolutely adore the people that adore their games and want to give them lots of stuff to do and to discover, which I think is commendable. Halo Reach initially got amazingly good reviews. I've never been a massive Halo fan. I just find that the universe too restrictive, and I the story of aliens invading and taking over humanity hasn't really interested me since reading H.G. Wells as a kid. I think with the game, it's one of those things where the people that loved it will like it because it gives them what they want, but the problem with it was that it had this kind of overblown narrative, and it was really reaching to be almost Oscar-worthy in some of its kind of story elements. Red Dead Redemption, for me, out of those, was far and away the most interesting and successful game, and an absolutely astonishing Western adventure, which was so cinematic, and cinematic in the right way. It wasn't trying to be cinema, but it created a canvas, a world which was so compelling, but full of so many kind of beautiful nuances, visual moments, and a world in which you could really inhabit.
Another massive trend has been social gaming, and not just the rise of casual gaming, but Zynga, for example, is a phenomenon in itself. How can you sum up what's happened in this space this year in a pithy and informative way?
A lot of people talked about Zynga's entry into the games industry as being almost like a David and Goliath situation. But now, looking back on the year, no one's really sure who the David was and who the Goliath was, because Zynga are enormous and enormously successful.
And Playfish as well.
Yeah,
actually.
Playfish, which obviously EA came in and bought, because what you're seeing now is the mainstream industry are desperate to tap in the social gaming dynamic.
Dollars in their eyes.
Exactly, yeah, because these games can be made in 6 months by a team of 20 people. And, you know, we've seen what's happened with Farmville. It's incredible. It's going to change the way games are made, I think, from now on.
Gamification. I know at the Playful conference they were sort of saying, hang on a minute, we didn't really mean it about gamification. You all took it a little bit too far. Are we getting a bit bored of gamification already, or do you think this is something that is just inevitably going to get much more mainstream?
As in the industry get more bored of it, I think it will become a reality beyond what we think it will be. I think we're all bored of it. We're all bored of talking about the big kind of successes of Foursquare and Epic Win, which are the most quotable examples of gamification. What a lot of people have come to realise is, well, it's just kind of like supermarket reward cards, but writ large.
Let's move on. Keith, Kinect and Move, they're just playing catch-up with the Wii, aren't they?
You could say that if you were being cynical. They kind of, in some ways, they are. They're trying to take Wii. Both Sony and Microsoft have gone, oh, hang on, Nintendo have become massively, massively successful by taking games away from people that like joypads. Move, I would say, is the thing that's tried to evolve Wii. The Move controller is the same sort of technology, and you actually hold the device in your hands, but it's a lot more accurate, and it works in conjunction with the camera, so there's kind of visual input, there's microphone input as well. Microsoft have tried to move beyond that and take the controller out of it completely. I haven't seen a game yet that has absolutely showcased this technology amazingly well. The launch games, as is often the case with hardware, have been okay and have shown glimpses of great promise, especially things like Dance Central was very good. But yeah, I think the technology has a lot to prove, and it could be that it remains in a kind of family gaming ghetto and never kind of crawls out of it.
Kinect takes us nicely into our next subject review in 2010. It's the one big name we can't fail to include.
What's so good is they haven't poured everything into it so that it does everything. And then they discover, well, actually, people don't like the way that it does that. They've actually said, look, this is clear and simple. This is how it works. And if you buy into it, and it's hard not to, it's very likeable. user interface. And you may say, oh, I wish you could do this and I wish you could do that. But you say that of the iPhone. You say that of a torch, you know, whatever device it might be. And I think this is exactly the right way to have gone about it.
So we've mentioned Kinect and the quick success Microsoft has had with that, but they've had another unexpected success with the launch of the Windows 7 phone, as you heard Stephen Fry telling Tech Weekly back in October. But it wasn't quite the same with another mobile device Microsoft launched in the US in the summer. The Kin 1 and 2 got terrible reviews and were killed within 2 months. And Robbie Bark, the executive responsible for devices and entertainment, retired this autumn. Microsoft have also had trouble taking their tablets. Despite announcing new devices that would be running Windows 7 at CES in January, which was before the world knew there would be an iPad, there are still no new Microsoft-powered tablets. And one of the manufacturers they previewed, HP, has bought Palm and will be developing the webOS for tablet devices in 2011 instead. Has that been a big failure of Microsoft this year, not to get into tablets again, at a time when everyone in the world is wanting to buy one?
Microsoft has been on tablets for a number of years. With Windows, of course, it doesn't work very well.
The Windows 7 phone, now, has this impressed you? Is it really good, or is it just that the previous Windows mobile was so bad that it's looked quite good?
I haven't experienced the phone myself firsthand yet, but I have spoken to developers who've used it, and they've been game developers that used it, and they've been very enthusiastic about it. Microsoft does seem to have been kind of evangelizing the technology quite well to game developers, especially kind of indie developers. There's a game which I kind of watched the development of from its genesis at a Game Jam event in Huddersfield. They've been really helped out with the game, and they've said the libraries are really good. They're working on the kind of APIs, trying to create a really good, strong foundation for app development. The noises from them and from other indie developers I spoke to have been really promising, and that's the best start you can make, I think, with the technology is getting those smaller developers on board and making sure that they're able to create the apps they want to.
And Microsoft has been falling over itself to reach out to developers and try and support them as much as possible, and I suppose they can also learn from what the Android marketplace didn't do that well and what Apple's done really well. But browser choice kicked off in March after that EU ruling, so that Windows users could pick any browser as well as IE. But consequently, the IE share has now dropped to under 50%, I think, by the autumn.
It's a great thing that the European Commission brought in that ruling, pro-competition ruling. It's done wonders for Chrome's market share. The problem for Microsoft is Internet Explorer is the vehicle into users' homes for delivering MSN. And so it doesn't necessarily mean great things for MSN if people find themselves accessing their internet homepage via Chrome, via Mozilla.
On Garden Technology, we've described MSN as the biggest site that nobody uses because it is the default portal for so many people, so their traffic must be plummeting right now. So another one to watch. Well, let's end with a bit of showbiz and an unlikely place to expect an Academy Award nomination. 2010 was the year that Coding made it onto the silver screen.
We have an idea that we'd like to talk to you about.
They don't want you, they want your idea.
We don't know what it can be, we don't know what it will be, we know that it is cool.
You called me a bitch on the internet.
Doesn't anybody have a sense of humor?
The internet's not written in pencil, Mark, it's written in ink.
Dude, maybe we shouldn't shut it down before we get into trouble.
Stole our website.
They're saying we stole the Facebook.
I know what it says.
So did we?
They came to me with an idea, I had a better one.
Let's sue him in federal court.
If you guys were the inventors of Facebook, you'd have invented Facebook.
Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg in The Social Network. The Facebook film is tipped for Oscar glory in February 2011. But back in the real world, Facebook was moving things forward in 2010. Zuck previewed his ambition to tie messaging from whatever platform into Facebook to simplify your inbox problems. And the site launched Places, its take on Foursquare and GoWalla-style location services. Bebo didn't have as much success this year, being sold by AOL for under $10 million, a fraction of the $850 million AOL paid for it. And last month, the Wall Street Journal said News Corp is open to all options for MySpace, as they said that losses are not acceptable or sustainable. Elsewhere online, YouTube turned 5 and saw off a $1 billion lawsuit from entertainment group Viacom after a judge ruled that the video site was protected for copyright infringement under US law as it had made efforts to take down content. Robert, Facebook reached 500 million users in July. That's active monthly users. When will it reach a billion? I mean, they've done the easy half, haven't they?
Finger in the air. At some point, I think they will. I can't tell you when. It could be next year.
And it's safe to say that that 50 million now is the heavy regular web users in the US and Western Europe. That's the easy to reach 50 million, isn't it? And we've seen them launch Facebook Zero this year, so that's free access for people in the developing world. Was that a clever strategy to try and build audience, do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, in any particular sector, there's often only room for one big gorilla, and that's why you've seen the likes of MySpace fall by the wayside. No coincidence that Facebook's user adoption curve has been going up and up in the opposite direction. So I think Facebook has dominance in its particular sphere right now. It may slow down. I don't see it going away. I think it's worthwhile asking, as with a lot of these big companies, if it can keep a pace. You know, I think it's worth asking if, for example, we've talked about some of Google's product missteps. Is Google anything more than a search company? Facebook is trying to augment itself with location, with search, but how successful is it going to be at those? Is Facebook anything more than a social network?
I said 50 million twice. I did, of course, mean 500 million. Bebo and AOL, and this was very interesting. This was like a real warning, isn't it, to big media companies of how not to acquire promising young companies.
Yeah, and I don't think that Bebo necessarily did anything wrong all by itself, but what happened was AOL got a new chief exec, a new broom swept clean, and has shifted the focus onto content, actually, a lot more like an old media company, never mind the social networking, the cool stuff.
Were they right to sell it, though?
Yeah, probably. I mean, they wanted to get away from the notion of being a connector of their users and move back to being a deliverer of content and entertainment and information to those users, because that's what you can sell lots of nice advertising against.
Keith, Yahoo has had a pretty rubbish year. Carol Bart's doing her best to sort of shovel the company into some sort of attractive shape and make it look like she's turning it around. But closing services like Delicious is not a positive sign for Yahoo, is it?
No, and I'm annoyed because just as I was beginning to understand how to use Delicious, suddenly the Delicious carpet gets pulled out from under my feet.
It's cruel.
Yeah. Yahoo's one of those companies now where I don't think even they know what they're for, do they? And I just think if there's another good cinema treatment of a big corporation, Facebook was very much the his social networking on the app. I think there could be a parallel horror movie about Yahoo.
I think they might have to make WikiLeaks before they do anything else, but yeah.
But it's the same kind of strategy, isn't it, as you're seeing with AOL and Bebo. It's getting rid of this social fancy stuff and moving back toward content. I see Yahoo's strategy as the same as AOL's strategy. And I totally wouldn't be surprised if they do come together at some point next year. And that will kind of be a really big last throw of the dice for online content. And I think, you know, they want to create a content powerhouse to be really successful in the online age in a way that some traditional media operators haven't been able to.
Channel 4 has closed down its innovation fund, 4IP, which funded a lot of businesses, some which probably would have gone on to be profitable and some which were more public service focused. But David Abram, the new chief executive, has decided that telly is what Channel 4 does, and it's going to chop off, cruelly prune, any other sprouts in any other direction. So companies like Chromaroma, and or Mudlark, rather, with the Chromaroma project, and Papa Sangre benefited from 4IP. Are we going to notice any difference, any projects that won't happen because of this?
I think it's too early to tell. When I spoke to Dutank, the developer based in Clerkenwell, who worked with something else on Papa Sangre, which is a really, really interesting iPhone application, they seem to think it was kind of a fixed two-year experiment which just came to a close. And all the people involved with that are now elsewhere in Channel 4 and still pushing the idea that, you know, interactive content applications are still important. I don't know if you've heard any different than me. Channel 4, I think, as part of their remit, are hopefully always going to be looking at interactive content, and certainly education, the education department at Channel 4, although I think they're just about to lose their key commissioning editor.
They have now lost her, in fact, Alice Taylor.
Yes, yeah, who was such a guiding force behind their success in getting small startup UK studios to create interesting offbeat games for the education sector. I wonder how things are going to go from there, but there's lots of plans for this year. There's lots of interesting things that they've got coming up. Lots of really interesting games. At the End from Preloaded, a game that's going to try and teach teenagers about death and how to talk about death. There's a game called Sweatshop as well that's coming out about running, you know, managing a sweatshop, which is quite an interesting idea from Channel 4 Education. So I hope that impetus is still there. It would be awful to think that it would go because of 4IP going.
I can't believe we've gone this far without mentioning Twitter. But there was a redesign. Advertising started to creep in, and they also took over the Tweety iPhone app and launched a very slick iPad app as well. How's 2010 been for Twitter, Robert?
It's been a banner year. With things like acquiring Tweety and making their own app out of that, they haven't always won friends with developers this year. Some of the developers, third parties, have already been doing some of this stuff themselves. But after a 2009 that was filled with a lot of hype and promise and growing adoption, that was the year in which the Twitter guys sort of sat back and took things easy and decided that they needed to be a little bit hands-off and let this community grow and evolve and not get too stuck in with trying to make it a business. But 2010 was the year in which they solidified that company as a business, and you can actually see some of the foundations there with advertising and other income streams, and it looks like next year Twitter could be really big in that sense.
There is a sense they're rather unhurried in their business plan in a very good way. They won't let the hype take over and they won't rush into any decisions, which is quite reassuring, but we will be watching them very closely. Well, that is it for this Tech Weekly review of 2010. What did you make of our list? Anything we missed out or didn't give enough time to? Let us know your thoughts by posting a message on the Tech Weekly programme page. You'll find it at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Next week, as mentioned at the start of the programme, we'll be looking to the future, predicting what we're going to be talking about in this programme in 12 months' time. Video on demand, PlayStation phones, and probably 3D TV again. Thank you very much to Keith and Robert, and to you for downloading and listening to us every week. That's all for now, though. I'm Jemima Kish. The programme was produced by Scott Corley. And have a very happy Christmas from everyone at Tech Weekly.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.